Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased and honored to have with us Professor Jeremy Black, CBE. Professor Black is Professor Emeritus at Exeter University. He is a Senior Fellow at the Policy Exchange and at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He has written well over 150 books, making him by far the most prolific historian writing in the Anglophone world today. And we are discussing today his latest book, one of his latest books, Tank Warfare, published by Indiana University Press. Welcome, Professor Black.
Hello.
Professor, what is the thesis of your book?
The attempt of the book is to re-examine the role of the tank in military history, and it comes in a sequence of books. I've done one on air power, one on naval warfare since 1816, one on counterinsurgency, one on combined operations, one on fortifications, etc., in which in each case what I've tried to do is to take the subject and instead of doing what so often is the case in which people tell you that this is the key thing and that if you don't understand this, you won't understand military history, I've tried instead the slightly harder task, but more mature task, of talking about the strengths and weaknesses of those particular weapons systems or means of warfare and tactical, operational, and strategic levels.
Why do you regard the influence of Sir Basil Liddell Hart on the historiography of tank warfare as being, quote, problematic, unquote?
Thank you. Well, problematic is a marvelous term. It's an academic term for me, for meaning that there are serious problems here. Little Hart was a man of great talent, and as indeed he was quite keen to tell you, but he was also primarily concerned to endorse, often without qualification, his own ideas. And he saw armor as providing a way to unlock what he regarded as often the impasse of the modern 20th century battlefield. And what I think happened as a result of that was to slant the, not just his own work, which is fair enough, I mean, everybody has their own interpretations, but also more particularly to slant the wider perception, because Little Hart was not just an influential, though not as much as he thought, writer in the 1920s and 30s, but he became very much the, if you like, the key popular writer on war in Britain in the post-World War II period. And he took roles, for example, his general editorship of Purnell's History of the 20th century, sorry, World War II, which I think in the United States was published by Ballantines, and he took roles which meant that his views could be widely disseminated.
What is your definition of a tank?
Oh, well, there you go. I mean, much of the book, it's a subtext. I mean, obviously, and I do discuss this in the book, I mean, usually people put in guns, armor, internal combustion engine, and tracts, though, as I then discuss, and we'll come to those in a second, but as I then discuss, that also means that you include things like self-propelled guns, which some people would call tanks and some people wouldn't. So essentially, you're combining mobility with firepower, the mobility provided by an internal combustion engine, as opposed to 19th century ideas that maybe you could have the equivalent of steam traction engines on land. The guns and the armor very much come from the extent to which, A, you want to provide protection, that's armor and firepower, but also in a way, and this is interesting, represent a extrapolation into land warfare of the model of the warship of that period. And the tracks are designed to provide all-terrain coverage and therefore differentiate a tank from, shall we say, an armored car, which is generally wheeled, and of course, but also has an internal combustion engine, guns and armor. Now, that all sounds very easy. But as you will know, that definition includes many fighting vehicles that are not always referred to as tanks. And in particular, what it means is that you move away from a focus on what has been increasingly called of recent decades the main battle tank. In other words, a very heavily armored vehicle which has a very powerful gun. So for the general public, let's say the Tiger tank or the Abrams tank. And in fact, if you're talking about guns and armor and internal combustion engines and tracks, you're also including, for example, those tanks of the 20s and 30s, which were armed essentially with machine guns. Now, some people refer to those as tankettes rather than tanks, but actually there is no inherent reason why the gun that we're talking about should fire a shell as opposed, you know, sort of an armor-piercing shell, as opposed to having a machine gun projectile. So there's no clear definition. There is a problem that most people, when they think of tanks, think of the more heavily armored, heavily gunned parts of the spectrum, but what that does is in fact almost prejudge the issue of the effectiveness of other, or otherwise of tank warfare.
What, if any, were the historical predecessor of the tank?
Well, wheeled vehicles that were armored, obviously, and could provide firepower. You can think, for example, of the chariot. Indeed, J.F.C. Fuller, in his book Tanks in the Great War, discusses chariots, and those generally carried people who were archers. You didn't have to have an archer in them, but so if you're thinking of the widespread fighting in the Middle East or in China, they have archers. Then other potential predecessors are armored battering rams or siege towers equipped with catapults. That's one type. Or you can then move into battle wagons, as used, for example, by the Hussites in the early 15th century. They had stone-filled carts with spikes to the fore that were rolled down hills. And their use resembles the initial use of tanks in World War I in helping to break through enemy ranks. And of course, war wagons were also used in much of the Islamic warfare of the early 16th century. None of these are that close to tanks, but nevertheless, they can all be seen as trying to combine mobility and firepower. I think it's really the 19th century, because it's in the 19th century that steam power, and in particular locomotive steam power, in other words, steam power that moves with the vehicle as opposed to a stationary steam engine, locomotive steam power carried with it the idea that you would actually be able to change the situation and combine firepower and mobility, and that this was the form of modernity. Now, what that left unclear was whether it would move on, when we're talking about land here, whether it would move on rails, and you get ideas of armoured electric-powered or steam-powered gunned vehicles moving fast on rails. And, of course, that leads to that 20th century use, as in the Chinese warlord era wars, or the Russian Civil War, or indeed they were used in the world wars of armored trains. The different thing about what we conventionally call the tank is this represented an attempt to the power not to be on the rails, but to be able to transverse land. And initially, as I've mentioned, the idea was that you would use the kind of power traction from steam, but that was rapidly changed to a sort of what were regarded as motor war cars, and that term was used early on. And by December 1914, Maurice Hankey, who was the secretary to the British Committee on Imperial Defence, an influential figure, there's just been an important new biography on him, referred to vehicles propelled from behind by motor engines, and the driver's seat armoured and with a Maxim, that's a machine gun, fitted. And that is, in a sense, part of where we're going. So then in 1915-1916, the British and the French pool together existing technologies. So you've got treads, you've got multiple wheel and multiple axle assemblies, you've got an armoured carapace, in effect an insect exoskeleton, and you've got limited traverse sponsons for the guns, and they all appear together in the form of the tank. And some of those come over from steam tractors, and some of those are innovations from warships.
Why did the British and the French, but not the Germans, invent the tank during the Great War?
Well, that's a fascinating question, Charles, and it's always difficult but interesting to try and explain why something doesn't happen. I mean, there are several things one could argue. You could argue that there was a greater degree of inflexibility in the German patenting of new weaponry. You could argue that the British, particularly the Admiralty, and Churchill is an important figure here, were very innovative in their approach to weaponry. Think, for example, of their role in developing bombing in 1914, for example, long-range bombing. So I think that there is a mixture of factors. The Germans also have enormous pressure on their metallurgy, their steel production. There's real pressure on that. I don't suppose that necessarily encourages innovation. And on top of that, of course, in 1915, their principal offensive is on the Eastern Front, where they don't really need to overcome sophisticated trench systems. In 1916, they do attack at Verdun, but they're relying fundamentally, as they do in their 1918 offensive, on artillery-backed infantry. And their major innovation in the second half of the war is the form of stormtrooper trying to break through and into opposing front lines by small groups of mobile infantry carrying weapons with them, rather than with a large prepared tank force. So they're going in different directions. But one of Germany's problems in both world wars is, although it is an industrially impressive society, it is also trying to act as the world power on the back of what in that sense is an inadequate industrial base. And I think that is a problem for them. It's a problem in World War II, of course, as well.
How successful was the tank in the Great War? Did it do what its inventors hoped it would do?
No, I don't. I think it's fair to say that the tank did not do what had been hoped for, although looked at differently the investment in the tank was understandably considerably more modest than the investment in either heavy artillery or indeed light artillery. I mean, the British use of the mortar, for example, and the development of the Stokes mortar is a very impressive form of technology. So the tank, discussion of the tank, as you probably know, it was first used by the British in 1916. A lot of the discussion of it relates to its use in 1917, the Battle of Cambrai, its use in 1918, the Battle of Amiens, and the plans for 1919. And tanks had value in these on these occasions, and there's no two ways about that. But also, and this is no surprise for a new weapon system, there were serious structural issues revealed, and also the enormous problems of maintenance and overcoming the problems of the terrain, of trenches, of shell holes, and so on. The tanks certainly were effective at a tactical level in breaking through and into German defences on the two offensives I've mentioned. But it would be wrong to abstract them from the general pattern of Allied military success in the second half of 1918. And that military success, as I've tried to show in my book on the Great War, is much more multifaceted. And I think it is more important to consider, in particular, the British dominance of the three-dimensional battlefield, the use of aerial reconnaissance to provide very accurate artillery fire, and also the development of more effective infantry assaults. And if you're looking, therefore, at the great success, which is that the Western Allies, so that includes, obviously, the Americans, break through the German front line in 1918, break through the Hindenburg line, defeat the main battle army of the German army, whereas in 1944-45, although their achievement was enormously impressive, the reality was the main German units were facing the Soviets. That success by the Allies in 1918 is one that is helped by tanks, but not caused by tanks.
In his private diary, at the beginning of the Battle of Cambrai in November 1917, Field Marshal Sir Douglas Haig noted that tanks, in order to be used properly, needed to have infantry as, quote, skirmishers to clear away hostile guns, unquote. Would you agree with him circa November 1917?
Yes, I think I would agree with him. And indeed, I would agree with that in general with tanks. I mean, the problem with any weapon system is what the other side throw up against it as the anti-weapon system. And most people think that the standard anti-weapon system against a tank is another tank. But actually, generally, it isn't. And in World War One, it certainly wasn't. The if you're looking at Cambrai in 1917, apart from the large number of tanks that fall foul of mechanical failings, the Germans make the most of their damage to the British tanks by artillery fire. On the first day at Cambrai, 65 British tanks were destroyed thanks to direct hits by German artillery fire. They're slow moving. There isn't, as it were, much cover on a World War One battlefield. The trees are all gone. And ordinary field guns employing just direct fire and firing high explosive shells were very effective. On top of that, anti-tank mines, which originally were just shells buried with the fuses just below the surface, were also effective. So what Haig was saying was correct. And I think the speed of the tank in World War One exemplifies the need for combined operations. You then get, and this is one of the areas in which Little Heart does go adrift, you then get this sort of, later in the century, this cult of the tank, that it can be, as it were, able to surpass other weapon systems, that it doesn't need to be coordinated with them. And what, in a sense, World War II demonstrates, and indeed is to be demonstrated anew for the Israelis in 1973, is that you actually do need combined operations in order to be successful.
Which military power and which theorist in the interwar period best anticipated the future usage of the tank as per what occurred during World War II?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and my answer would be nobody. My answer would be that what I would point out is that the military powers that had people who talked about tanks and who made developments with tanks and who acquired tank forces, and you can think here of the Soviets, the British, the French, the Germans being the most obvious, nevertheless remained understandably dominated by generals who had made their way up. Their formative experiences were in 1917, 1918, and they tended to put the emphasis on infantry and armor. So in Britain, infantry and artillery. So in Britain, people like Milne, who was chief of the Imperial General Staff, or Montgomery Massingbird, who had the same position. In Germany, people like Sect, for example, in the 1920s, these were the key figures. To a certain extent, it requires particular reasons to explain why changes occur. So in Germany, which is what people usually focus on, one of the things that's very interesting is that the military leadership of the army is completely transformed between 1938 and 1941, which very much does mean that people offering newer solutions come more to the fore. In the Soviet Union, as you probably know, the standard argument is that there was this brilliant military system, that this was all understood to Khrushchev, that these people were purged by a stupid Stalin, and that then the hard lessons had to be relearned. I think that exaggerates the capacity of the Soviet tank force in 36-37. And indeed, the maneuvers of 36 had shown some quite serious flaws with them. So I'm not sure that one would say that anybody, and this is not surprising, the tanks, it's like the aircraft. The tanks and aircraft of the 20s and the 30s were not really up to the specifications. So, for example, take bombing. You could have air power theory at the beginning of the 20s, and you can talk about Mitchell and Trenchard and Douay and all the rest of it. But in practical terms, as I tried to show in my book on the history of air power, it's really 1943, 44, 45, where you see the capacity for long-range heavy bombing. And of course, you need, in the case of the assault on Germany, you need long-range fighters to go with that. So the technologies come together at a particular stage. And I would point out that many of the tanks being used in 38, 39, 40, in the early stages of World War II, are very vulnerable indeed to not just mechanical breakdown, as of course was a big problem for the Germans in Blitzkrieg, but also, in fact, to defending artillery fire.
What does the German success in 1940 and 1941 tell us about the then evolution of tank warfare?
Well, what I would argue is that the German strategy and operational plan in 1940 is risky, that it succeeds in large part because of serious deficiencies of French strategy and planning, particularly the deployment of French mechanized reserves on the advancing left flank, so they weren't available in a reserved capacity. And I would argue that as a result of that, the French flaws magnify the German capability rather than the German capability being able to determine victory. I mean, that's how I would see it, and I've tried to argue that in a number of books on World War II. And I do think people are apt to forget the problems that affected the German use of armor in that period, and indeed the limitations of German doctrine. I mean, it's worth bearing in mind that Blitzkrieg wasn't a unified concept, and it's possibly best to use phrases such as the effective use of air and mechanized forces rather than to use Blitzkrieg. And, you know, what I would argue is that, well, you know, what we know, much of the German army was unmechanized. It walked into battle. The reality of weaponry and logistics based on the internal combustion engine was only poorly understood. And I think that there is a real problem in the way in which Blitzkrieg is often written about. But as you know, I've argued that extensively elsewhere. I mean, I do discuss it in this book on the tank, but in that respect, my book on the tank is not new as far as my own work is concerned.
What does German strategic failure in the Russian front in 1941-1942 tell us about the limitations of tank warfare?
Well, again, that's a fascinating question. I mean, the Germans have multiple problems with their strategy on the Eastern Front, not least that they hadn't satisfactorily worked out how they were going to impose defeat on the and surrender on the Soviets, as opposed to killing a lot of them and taking territory. And they obviously suffered from a lack of an ability to determine whether they were principally interested in seizing particular areas of territory or making particular assaults on percentages of the Soviet war machine. And they also found it difficult to deal with the Soviet defense in depth. So there's multiple elements of flaws, and that's only just a few of them. And I've not once mentioned the word tank in that matter. But if you're looking at specifically at tanks, I mean, the Germans also suffered from a lack of investment in tank production. They launched 3,350 tanks, German, that includes the Romanians, but most of them were German. They launched those at on the Eastern Front, but there was actually insufficient tanks in number, and increasingly so, because if you look at the map, you'll be aware as the Germans move eastwards, the front of their advance expands, and that's because of the configuration of the Baltic. They're also, their armor was affected by the abysmal way in which the Germans run logistics. So there were serious fuel shortages, there were major maintenance problems, there was a shortage of spare parts and ammunition. All of those are very serious problems for the Germans throughout the war. Their ability to repair their tanks in situ was lower than that of their opponents, etc., etc. So there are big problems with the German tank force, qua tank force, and that leaves aside the question of their actually being committed in support of a very poor strategy. So it's not surprising that they have major difficulties, and they're also starting to be up against not just the effectiveness of the Soviet defensive artillery, but also the fact the Soviets now have impressive tanks. Now, I think it's fair to say that if you're looking at armored warfare in 41, first of all, the Germans are losing more tanks than they anticipate from day one. But nevertheless, they prove more effective in mobile warfare than the Soviets do. The Soviet use of their tanks isn't always good, but nevertheless, Soviet tanks can still destroy German ones. And you've got the Soviets have got the T-34, and then you've got a series of other Soviet tanks. You've got their heavy tank, the KV-1A, which is, you know, it's got a 76.2mm gun. That's a significant gun, and that same gun was carried by the T-34. So these are formidable tanks. And now, on the one hand, that leads the Germans to upgrade their medium tanks and also to press forward with the development of the heavy tanks, and you can focus on the German success in doing that. But it's equally well to point out that they reveal the deficiencies of the provision of German tanks at that point.
Would it be true to say that the Allied Anglo-American Russian or Soviet, emphasis on producing in mass standard issue and serviceable, albeit slightly inferior design, weapons, including tanks, was one of the key variables in the eventual Allied victory?
Well, I think it's very important. I think you're absolutely right in that, Charles. I think it's very important. But I wouldn't wish to necessarily say that the Allies therefore had worse tanks always than their opponents. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that not all the German tanks are Tiger Ones or Panthers, for example. So the Germans are still deploying a lot of other tanks. So I think one's got to be careful in that. And also, there are a tank, as we mentioned earlier, brings together a lot of technologies. And some of the ones that one's got for the Allies are actually very good. So the British are using very good armor-piercing shells, providing, you know, sub-caliber projectiles that actually can do a lot of damage. And, you know, these are able to penetrate much German armor. And on top of that, the British 25-pounder field gun, you know, is probably the most effective field gun by the end of the war. And that, again, can, you know, produce a certain amount of mess. I mean, remember, with the tank, you don't just have to penetrate its tank armor, which is often very difficult, in order to wreak damage with it. You can simply cause damage to the tracks of the tank, and that can cause a lot of problems. I mean, as you may know, for the United States, there's a lot of debate as to whether the late arrival of the M26 Pershing, which had a 90mm gun, whether that was a flaw in American procurement, or whether, in fact, this was a sensible response to the needs of the force profile needs of the United States forces. And you can have tanks that are too big and not well thought out. I mean, the Germans, after all, produced a number of those in prototype form. And I think it's fair to say that the Allies, you know, had some problems in this respect. I mean, there was a tank called the Black Prince, which was a British prototype for a heavier Churchill tank, but it turned out to be underpowered and could only reach 11 miles an hour. So in other words, that's a classic example of a tank that was too big. It had a good gun, but, you know, it was just hopeless. But what you're bringing out very successfully is that there is no perfect specification for a tank or any other weapon system, and that one of the things that you need to think about is the practicality in production, the practicality in training, the practicality in maintenance, and the practicality in deployment. Now, I mention all of those in my book on technology and war, and I would say tanks exemplify those points.
My son, Alex, who is a tank devotee, particularly the tanks of the Second World War, wanted to ask you the following question. Which tank was better in operational combat, T-34 or Panzer III?
In the quantities available, I would go by Panzer III. I take it he means in the quantities available, I would go for the T-34. I think the point you made earlier about the numbers available is an important point, because a German tank ran the risk of being mobbed, as it were, and that, I think, is very important, particularly if it could involve being attacked from the side and the back. But a lot does depend. If you're looking, and what I would say to your son is, if he's looking at how tanks operate as individual weapons, a lot does depend upon the skill of the commander and the particular terrain. So in other words, it's your ability to sense where your opponent is. It's your ability to understand the potential lines of fire of opposing tanks and anti-tank guns. All of those are significant. Now, for the German tanks that you are mentioning, much of the usage that people focus on is on 1943 to the end of the war, in which, although there are German offensives on the Eastern Front, the last significant one is Kursk, and thereafter the German tanks are and tank forces on the Eastern Front are always on the defensive. So with reference to his question, it partly depends upon the ease of defending the particular terrain they are in and the extent to which the other side, the opposing side, the attacking side, is supported by air superiority and artillery superiority. So if you've got a well-dug-in German tank with a clear field of fire, then it is going to beat a T-34. If, on the other hand, you have, as you increasingly did by the last 2 years of the war in particular, Soviet cannon fire, rocket firing as well, sort of ground attack aircraft, plus significant artillery support, and you don't have an ability to dig yourself in, then the German tank is in many respects a dead duck, particularly at daylight. Nighttime it's easier, of course, but particularly at daylight. So partly it really does depend upon the specifications. The same thing I would say in Normandy. I mean, obviously the individual German tanks there can be very impressive and inflicted a lot of damage on Allied tanks. But it's worth bearing in mind that the German tanks proved less effective in the offensive in the Normandy campaign, for example, the battle around Mortain, whereas they proved more effective combined with anti-tank guns in resisting Allied advances, say Operation Goodwood. And again, it's worth bearing in mind that German tank forces caught in the open by Allied ground attack aircraft, you know, it doesn't matter how good the individual tank's going to be, it is vulnerable. It is seriously vulnerable.
Would it be true to say that the Soviets were better able to deploy, or I should say employ, tanks in deep penetration operations than the British and the Americans?
Yes. I mean, I think that it's fair to say the Soviets had the advantage in the sense that they'd started off doing that earlier. The distances were greater, and if you're looking at it from the perspective of the British and the Americans, Italy doesn't lend itself to deep penetration offensives, although it's worth bearing in mind that both the British and the American commanders messed up the exploitation of June, July 1944. In France, I think it's generally agreed that the British and the Americans were not as good at exploiting the situation created by the Normandy breakout. But in their favour, the logistical situation was very, very difficult for them. And of course, they were being expected to move rapidly from the close quarter, high tempo fighting in Normandy to an exploitation advance. But what they didn't successfully do is outmaneuver and cut off large defending forces after the Falaise operation. The German forces that were cut off were ones that had stayed in coastal fortifications or instructed to do so by Hitler. But the bulk of the German army in France is able to retreat to the German frontier, where they then put up a good struggle in areas like the Hunsrück against the Americans and, of course, at Arnhem against the British. And in part, I mean, some of those units had been moved from elsewhere, but in part it reflects the failure of the Western Allies to do better at exploiting their breakthrough. On the other hand, the Americans and the British do a good job once they've broken across the Rhine in 45 in launching deep penetration offensives, which prevent the Germans creating new defensive lines. I mean, the Germans go on fighting hard. many of them, you know, absolutely imbued with Nazi ideology to the end. And they go on inflicting a lot of casualties. And the British and the Americans prove extremely successful, the British in overrunning northwest Germany and breaking through to the Baltic, the Americans in overrunning the large areas of Franconia and Bavaria. So those are, there's a higher level of effectiveness in 45 than in 44, and I'm not surprised at that.
Why are you skeptical about the Soviets' post-1945 ability to overrun Western Europe in a war with the NATO powers?
Well, I'm skeptical about their ability to do it with a mass armor advance. I mean, I think that the a lot of the Soviet mechanization in 43, 44, 45 was dependent, at least in part, on Allied, sorry, British and American supplies of working parts, for which the Soviets had only a limited production capability. And also, the Soviets would have had, you know, their forces were very variable in quality, and they would have been up against units which had not been exhausted by frequent fighting, in most cases on the Eastern Front, frequent defeat over the previous 2 years. I'm not saying, though, that the Soviet Union, if it had attacked as it planned to do, would not have been a formidable challenge. Obviously, the nature of that challenge varies depending upon what you're assuming is going to happen with atomic weaponry. If you assume that atomic weaponry, including tactical nuclear weapons, is going to be used rapidly, then quite frankly, the armor would only be able to achieve so much. If, on the other hand, you are assuming that how should one put it, that there would be a non-nuclear war, that both sides would try and avoid nuclear, the use of nuclear weaponry, then clearly the success of respective tank forces would have been important.
What would you say was the most successful tank of the Cold War era?
Oh, that's a fascinating question, because, of course, most of the tanks were not used as had been intended in the very kind of struggle we've just been talking about. So, for example, you know, you're not getting, if you're looking at Soviet, say, T-54s or 55s or 62s, they're not being used by trained Soviet units. They're being used by, say, the Syrians in 1973, who are much less good. Equally, the Israelis are using, for example, in that very war, American M48s and M60s. So a lot does depend upon whom is using the respective armor. The Soviets made not bad armor, but it tended to be used mostly by forces which often had a sort of organizational rigidity, which is one of the great problems for the Egyptians, the Syrians, and the Iraqis. The American tanks used by the Israelis, the tanks are fine, but what's crucial is that the Israelis are, although their fighting effectiveness deteriorates against the Egyptians in 1973, but the Israelis, on the whole, outfight and outcommand their opponents. And I think that's a very important point. By the end of the Cold War, you've also got large numbers of tanks produced by different powers. I mean, thinking, for example, about the German Leopard tank, which is a very good mobile tank, able to move at speed. But I think it's fair to say we don't have a war to test out how well that would have done in the event of the Soviets advancing through the Fulda Gap. So a lot of it does depend, not so much about the tank, but about the usage of the tank. and goes back to what we were talking about earlier when we discussed the relationships between main battle tanks, you will recall, and lighter tanks. It's not that one is necessarily better than another. In part, it also depends upon what your intentions are for them. If your intentions for tanks are to take part in helping in coups, as, for example, let's say in Chile in 1973, you need a very different kind of tank to if you're proposing to engage with other main battle tanks.
How, if at all, did tank warfare evolve in the post-45 period?
Well, there wasn't a large-scale sustained war between very significant tank war forces. There were conflicts, the India-Pakistan one, the the Arab-Israeli ones, the Iraq-Iran ones, in which tanks were important, but they weren't on the scale of the possibility of a clash on the North German plain, which had been what NATO and the Warsaw Pact had been prepared for. What tank warfare showed is that it was most significant as part of combined operations. So, for example, in the conflicts we've been mentioning, or for example, in the use by North Vietnam of tanks in its offensive in 1972, the Easter or Spring Offensive, tanks were vulnerable to air attack. That was shown. Tanks were also shown to be vulnerable. Well, this was known, of course, but this was shown because, and this became more the case as guided missiles became, rather than dumb bombs, became much more used. So the vulnerability of tanks to air attack increased, and ditto with anti-tank guns, and in fact even more anti-tank missiles and heat-searching missiles were a problem for both tanks and for aircraft.
Would it be true to say that tank warfare was not for you a deus ex machina, but one variable among many in the Israeli victories in their wars with the Arabs?
I think that's absolutely correct. I think that you've hit it on the nail. That doesn't mean tanks were not without consequence, but it does mean you shouldn't write your history around them as if they made the total and fundamental difference. And of course, the Israelis discovered that. There was an overconfidence in the run-up to 73 and in 73 itself. And they discovered that at the tactical level up against, for example, as did the Israeli Air Force, up against Egyptian missiles. But they also discovered it in a very different context strategically in terms of the use of the army, which proved much better in its conventional role of attacking or defeating other Arab forces rather than as an occupation force coping with the strains of insurrection.
In your conclusion, you state, quote, "The future of the tank is unclear," unquote. Why is that the case? And what can we safely say about the future of the tank?
Well, I think it's certainly true that the future of the tank is unclear. It's an expensive system. It's vulnerable to explosives and to missiles. It has enormous cost implications. I mean, all of those points, and I discussed those at some considerable length, and I think those are important because all too much of the writing about tanks focuses on World War One, World War Two, and these Cold War conflicts we've mentioned. And as I've said, I in my book, I try and give a lot of weight to the recent usage of tanks and to current discussion. As you will know, some forces, the United States Marines, for example, the British Army, have been discussing either ending tank usage or putting tank usage very much under question marks, whereas there are other militaries, the Iranians, the Russians, the Chinese, that are developing new generation tanks. So clearly tanks go on providing mobility and firepower, but they are only useful if you have a considerable number of them. And I'm not sure that that really provides one with the wherewithal to deal with some of the great military challenges of the modern age, both weapon challenges. You know, I mean, after all, a drone can be used to literally attach itself to a tank and blow it up. So both weapon challenges, which you might regard as tactical challenges, but also on top of that, strategic challenges. What exactly are you going to do with tanks that might be able to parade down a boulevard but may not be able to do very much if you're facing large-scale insurrection?
If you wanted people to take one thing away from this book, what would it be?
And what I would like them to take away from it is that military, and I'd like to feel they would take away from all of my books on war, and there are many of them, that military history is a serious subject, that while it is interesting to present it as is fashionable at the moment in terms of face of battle and, you know, the experience of the individual soldier, and whilst that produces some brilliant books, and I know and respect those people that write them, nevertheless, you need a serious discussion at every stage of the strengths and weaknesses at the tactical, operational, and strategic level of weapon systems on their own and in combination. And that is what I'm trying to do. If people risk their lives, they need to feel that other people are devoting their intelligence and their ability to try to understand what can best be achieved by force. All too much of the literature doesn't really adequately address that. But this is what I have tried to do in my work on military studies.
On that observation, which I would like to agree with entirely, I would like to thank you very much, Professor Black, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor Black.
Thank you very much.